Okay, so thank you all for coming. So our speaker today is Enrique Rubira. So he's currently a postdoctoral fellow at the Technical University of Munich. So Enrique works on topics in large-scale structure and also gravitational waves. And today he's going to tell us all about his recent work on, you know, on bridging the gap between QFT and cosmology. So please take it away, Enrique, when you're ready.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Neil. Yeah, so it's been a while since I gave a Zoom talk, but please feel comfortable to jump in and ask questions because, you know, I feel sometimes I'm talking alone in the Zoom meetings, so I don't mind having questions and being interrupted. I'm very happy, actually. So today I'm going to talk about this work I did in collaboration with Fabian Schmidt, and it's about bridging the gap between QFT and cosmology and connecting those two different topics, which is renormalization group, which we imported from particle physics, this concept of coupling constants evolving with this smoothing scale that you have. And the second thing we want to connect is the galaxy bias parameters. So the large scale structure is described in this galaxy bias expansion with a set of three coefficients. And we want to study how those coefficients evolve with the smoothing scale that you have, with the lambda scale that you have. So what we have here is the main message to take home from this project, which is what we have derived, which is this Callan-Simons equation for the galaxy bias parameter. So what you see here is how those galaxy parameters evolve as a function of this smoothing scale lambda that you have. So on the left-hand side, you have B1, also called B delta here, B2, B delta squared, and BG2, which is this Galilean operator, and how they relate to the other bias parameters on the right-hand side. So basically what you see, it's a couple set of differential equations, and what sets in the speed of this evolution with respect to lambda, this smoothing scale, is this parameter d sigma lambda over the lambda, which basically is the variance of the linear density field on the scale lambda. So whenever you try to solve those equations, you ask mathematics to solve those equations, you find the solutions that you see here on the right. So how the bias parameters evolve as a function of lambda. And we fix here for one set of specific initial conditions. And you can see, for instance, that for those initial conditions, we have B1 evolving from positive here in this region, going to negative here, if you just increase the smoothing scale that you have. Also BG2, that's zero here in those scales, can actually be sourced by the other parameters, as you see here in this equation. And what you see on the bottom plot is one slice in this RG flow evolution. So it's B delta over B delta squared, and also for some other fixed parameters and conditions. And you can see exactly this RG flow, this very beautiful feature from particle physics that we imported here. And what we're analyzing, how the bias parameters evolve as you basically increase your lambda parameter. There are many nice things to explore, and we're just starting with this agenda. So I just list here a few things that we're exploring and starting to explore, and very nice things from this framework. So it's a very systematic way to construct the basis of operator that you have in your bias expansion, because you can actually, in practice, check if they're closed under renormalization, if you're including all the bias parameters you have to include. Also, it's a very systematic way to renormalize all endpoint functions straight ahead. You don't have to keep going for, you know, for the two-point function, you have a set of bias coefficients that you have to renormalize. I'm going to explain what I mean by renormalization of those bias parameters in this talk. But I have to say here is that you have actually to subtract some infinities. And it's an easy procedure for two-point functions, but already very complicated for three-point functions. And within this framework, basically everything is finite in lambda, and you don't have to subtract infinity. So it's a very systematic way to renormalize endpoint functions too. Also, it's very useful for extra cross-checks because you can actually check how your bias parameters evolve as a function of lambda. You can put points on top of those lines and check if there are anything missing. For instance, if you're missing some two-loop contribution, if you're missing some, you know, extra bias parameters or whatever. Also, something we're starting to explore, I'm going to talk about more in this talk, is we actually have more information coming from galaxy clustering within this framework? Can the RG equations actually bring more information? It is something to be investigated, but I'm going to point to some directions which I think are interesting. Right. So let me move now to the introduction, which is basically saying that cosmology is in a very super data-driven era because we have a lot of data coming from CMB, TT, plus polarization. We also have large-scale structure, amazing experiments coming from DAO, for instance, DAO measurements, and also Lansing data. So we are living in an era in which we have a lot of data, and theory has actually to catch up and be able to provide some guidance for how to analyze those data. Also, Something I want to point out is that as more data we collect, some tensions start to emerge. What I'm showing here on the left is how the age node measurements has evolved with time. And what we see on top is shoes and leather measurements. And what we see here on the bottom are basically plank and CMV measurements. And we start to see since 10 years ago, some tensions coming from plank measurements with respect to what we see from shoes. So this is what's called the age node tension. Also on the right here, not at the same level as the age node tension, but we have what's called the SA tension, which is this parameter, which is the amplitude of fluctuations scaled by omega n. And what we see is some tension between CMV data that gives us larger values for these amplitude of fluctuations compared to what we see, especially from lensing, but also from BAO measurements and full shape measurements, of course. But those tensions here bring us some questions. And also one of the main topic of this talk is how can theory catch up both from the model perspective, how can we provide models that can be checked and actually address those tensions, being guided by those tensions if you take them seriously. It's quite hard to be consistent with all those data coming from CMV, supernova, and structure formation. And another question is, what are well-motivated models from the particle physics perspective? And the main point of this talk, which is going to be the second part of this talk, is how can we provide model-independent tools to analyze this data? We have learned a lot from high-energy physics analysis in the last decades, and can we import those tools that we have used, these effective field theory tools that we have used to analyze high-energy physics data and actually apply them to cosmology? And as I'm going to show, and this is the main topic of this talk, we have these RG equations, which is something that we have important and we think can actually add some to cosmology. Right, so let me start here from part one, which is very short and trying to think about models and some models I have worked with, specifically trying to address the age node tension and the SA tension. So when we think about the age node tension, one of the models people talk about normally is these early dyke energy models in which we have some new component, phi here, scalar field, with a typical canonical potential for with this cosine potential with some power to the end. And I'm just importing this plot from this paper here. And what you see is that whenever you start to add SA, data here, the preference for this type of model is actually a bit more complicated. So this canonical early dark energy story goes a bit more in the tension side with respect to S state in this vanilla early dark energy scenario. But something people are starting to think about is can we actually have something different during recombination time? And one model I find quite interesting comes from this paper here that I'm showing here, and something we are working on to improve this model, analyze more, is can we have a phase transition in the early universe actually being responsible for that, basically putting together both SA tension and age node tension. Specifically for this model, we have seen that in this case, it provides some good guidance. So it's just some modification, this early dark energy story to include a phase transition. And it also provides very good connections with what we have seen recently with gravitational waves. So there's a lot of excitement with gravitational waves, especially after nanograph results. And there is a very interesting connection with that. So I have also a parallel life. This is just an aside. I have a parallel life calculating gravitational waves from phase transitions. So if there is anyone interested in hearing talking about that later, I would, of course, be very happy. And we have what's called the Higgs-less simulations for phase transitions, which has a lot of advantages compared to the usual probes. I would, of course, should be very happy to talk about that later. But let's move back to the main topic, which is what kind of models can address those tensions. So I'm moving on to the other tension, which is the SA tension. And as I mentioned, this is a tension between the amplitude of fluctuations, sigma 8 versus omega n. And what you see here is measurements from structure formation, both from lensing. So what you see here is lensing measurements, and this is Boltzmann measurements. And those are the Planck results. And what we see is these two sigma tension between those results. So I'm just flashing here the amplitudes of fluctuations on a scale R. Basically, it's the moving of the linear part spectrum. And one of the models we have analyzed in this context to try to address the SA tension is what's called this ETOS model, which stands for Effective Theory of Structure Formation. And it comes with the usual lambda CDM sectors that we normally have, plus one dark radiation sector that interacts with dark matter. So one of the parameters of this model is the amount of dark radiation we have, which is given by Xi here, this Xi value, which is the temperature of this dark radiation species that you have. Also, you have one extra parameter, which is the fraction of matter that actually interacts with this dark radiation species, plus some amplitude, which sets how strong this scattering is. This, of course, comes with a redshift dependence, which basically controls the velocity dependence of this interaction and how strong it is depending on different scales. So the way to think about that is you take Boltzmann equation for this interaction with dark matter and have a new amplitude here, which sets the interaction between this dark matter species with dark radiation. And when we think about addressing the SA tension, this is a very nice model because it gives us this direction in this plane, which is this the SA plane with the parameter we're trying to alleviate the tension with respect to lambda CDM and for instance, length measurements. And what we see is that whenever you start to add dark radiation, you start to have this parameter direction here, which actually can be a good point to solve this SA tension. One of the features of this model, which is one of the reasons why it's interesting, is because when we compare the scattering of these of dark matter and dark radiation in this model compared to Hubble, there is a flat region here in redshift, which means it provides a suppression in the matter spectrum from a broad range of scale. So namely, it provides a mild suppression in the linear spectrum from a long range of scales, which is actually a very smooth way to solve the SA tension. In other scaling indexes N that I'm plotting here, we don't see this degeneracy, this parameter direction here, which means specifically for those models here, we can actually not solve because they provide this sharp transition between having a strong interaction to a weak interaction. All that to say that this is a very interesting model, and it's also a very interesting model to connect high energy physics to cosmology because it provides this type of connection between a Lagrangian. You can draw a Lagrangian and connect to these ETOS parameters. So what you see here is like Lagrangian for a dark SUN with a typical kinetic term with some dark matter connected gauged by this gauge interaction. And what we did also in this work together with Matthias Garnier and Asma Mutsung, what we did is calculating exactly how to connect the Lagrangian parameters to what we observe in cosmology. So what I'm showing here is exactly the same amplitude that you see that I was showing before. But now in terms of some Lagrangian parameters, so exactly the parameters that enter your Lagrangian, you can actually plot here the Lagrangian parameters and see what regions in this Lagrangian parameter space are preferred whenever you take the S8 values, whenever you want to take those S8 values to lower values to be consistent at the same time with both CMB and structure formation data. So let me also mention the work that Asma, the student that was also in this other work, is doing. So we're helping, basically helping to supervise her in this work, which has the idea of using galaxy clusters to test this model in specific. The idea is whenever you take lambda CDM to be the true scenario, can actually galaxy clusters provide constraint in this type of model? And what you see here is some projections from CBS4 times Euclid. And if say lambda CDM is actually the true model, what we have seen in this work is actually that galaxy cluster can provide a good guidance and exclude exactly this parameter region, which provides smaller values of SA.
So sorry, it's a good way. Can I ask a question before you move on? Can you go back to the previous slide? Maybe it's the one before, but so did you say how this affects the Hubble?
No, this doesn't affect Hubble. So this is just the ratio between the interaction and Hubble. So this is a flat region in parameter space, which means that Hubble over this ratio is constant over some period of time.
No, but I'm asking, I mean, in terms of the constraints, because I mean, your triangle plot on the left is how the constraints on SA change in this new model.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So I'm just saying, so does this increase the Hubble or decrease? How does that affect Hubble measurement?
Well, adding these new species, of course, adds a new component, which sums up these basically change Hubble the same way as a delta and effective. So it's a dark radiation species that increases Hubble for a while.
No, but I'm saying in terms of in the constraint, I mean, in terms of how it changes the best fit value for H0 today.
Oh, right. Oh, sorry. I see. Right. So this goes in the same direction as this dark radiation species solution. So as we know, dark radiation is not enough to solve Hubble. So this goes in the right direction, but not enough to solve H0 and S8 at the same time.
Okay, thank you.
Right. So the idea here is actually, can we test this model like in the future? Is it testable? And what we have seen here is that actually the universe respects some model like this interacting dark matter, dark radiation model. What we see is actually galaxy clusters will be able to pin down quite well this model, this region in parameter space with respect to the other region in parameter space. It's actually adding this data, galaxy clusters in specific, will introduce a lot of new new perspectives for this type of models. Right, so let me move now to the second part of this talk, which also brings me a chance to drink some water, which is the main part of this talk, which is the tools that we can use in part from the particle physics community and apply them to cosmology. Right, so we have nowadays what's called the effective field theory of large scale structure, which is very powerful. What I'm showing here is just a representation of what we actually measure in cosmology, which are those endpoint functions, specifically like the two-point function here that you see, and galaxies from SDSS catalog here. And the effective field theory of large scale structure provides a very nice parameterization. Here is just one example of the two-point function on how we can parameterize this two-point function in terms of a set of free coefficients. There's a lot of people that have worked on that. I'm just listing the most general parameterization that we have in terms of the Bayes expansion with a set of free coefficients here that comes from this Bayes expansion, and another set of coefficients which are called contour terms, which basically cancel out the UV dependence and parameterize UV physics for the two-point function here. Also, there is this other component, which is called stochasticity, which represents how small-scale modes affect basically the large-scale modes and how they can be parameterized as a stochastic contribution that sums, for instance, as a shot noise term. So there's a lot of advantages from considering this approach. I'm just listing here some advantages and some cons that people also complain many times that it has many free parameters and you have to feed those free parameters. For instance, as considering them as nuisance parameters. But it comes with many pros. First, I don't like calling them nuisance parameters because they have very clear physical meanings. All those Bayes parameters are associated with some clear physics and also the contour terms. And we are quite sure they provide the full and correct nonlinear parameterization of structure formation. It's also very trivially generalized to other high-order endpoint functions and also other models. So for me, it's actually a big advantage to have many parameters in that case and to be sure you're not getting bias on your model and you have the full correct parameterization whenever you go to mild nonlinear scales. So I'm actually happy to have those parameters. As I'm going to show, I don't think it's a big problem. So one of the reasons why EFT-FLSS is so successful is that it has gone through many blinded analyses. What I'm showing here is one of those blinded analysis results. And what we see is that two different teams actually agree on the values of AS, Mega M, and H0 measured over a broad range of scales and with a very nice precision. And we see that the deviations expect exactly where we expected, which is where this one loop contribution starts to thing. So the state of the art of those calculations include using the bispectral multipoles. I'm just showing here the bispectral multipoles. And it's basically, we're having a lot of fast progress in this field. So let me flash here one of the results that we had, which is the tree loop calculation.
I have a question. Yeah. Can you go to the previous slide? So what are the error bars here? No, I mean the other one, the next one.
Yep.
Yeah, so what are the bands here and what are the error bars?
So this was a test done over a huge simulation. So this simulation, I think, with hundreds of gigaparsecs. And what the error bars here show are some projections. I'm not 100% sure, but I think it's some projections for, I think it's the Bose error bar that you expect, or?
You mean the bands, yeah?
Yeah, the bands. The error bars here are over this huge simulation set.
Yeah, but then there is some systematic bias, right? Starting at Kmax bigger than 0.14, it looks like in delta in AAS and then.
Oh yeah, for B1 here, you start to see this offset. That's what I mean.
So yeah, so that's basically the sign that what next loop should be included, or
well, in this case, well, there is a trade-off here because so there's a comparison with a huge simulation, right? So it means your covariance is actually very precise, which means your error bars are quite small. So uh-huh. in the case of having these huge and very precise simulation, it means that the two loop contribution compared to your covariance is expected to contribute on earlier stage. So I would say it's an indication that actually you should truncate here in port 14 for this covariance. Mm-hmm.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah. Right. So let me just flash here this result, which is the true loop matter contribution. So this is a work I did in collaboration with Thomas Constantine and Rafael Porcho, which is including the tree loop contribution via the set of counterterms. So CS1, CS2 here are counterterms, C quad here are counterterms. So there is a huge set of counterterms for the tree loop contribution. And what I'm showing is the chi-square of the tree loop contribution as a function of k-max of your theory. And what we expected to see in this project, so at the time we had this project, this was 5 years ago already, we expected to go beyond the tree loop contribution. But what we see here is that the tree loop also finds this scale in which it gets worse compared to the two loop result. So it means two things for me. First, that the two loop result cannot reach 0.9 because you're basically overfitting your spectrum. It's also a Poor law, which means it's quite easy to overfit. And you have to include, for instance, the 3-point function to actually be sure you're not overfitting your spectrum.
Hi, sorry, but, can I ask a question?
No.
Sorry, I think you said it and I missed it. What are you fitting to again? Like what data are you fitting to?
So this is simulation.
Simulation, okay. And can you give me more information about the simulation? Is the simulation fitted to any data or is it just,
You mean the box size and these,
Okay, so it's just general. Okay, never mind. Okay.
I don't remember specifically the simulation. It was a long ago, but I remember it was something like the state of the art simulations for 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay, thank you.
Right, so what we see here is that the tree loop.
Could I also ask a quick question? I got a bit lost. Where do these interactions are coming from? Like, what is the EFD action here that like? If I want to track back the coupling or like what is causing which term?
Yeah, thanks. So this is effective theory for matter. So it means you're integrating out matter modes that are in the nonlinear regime, which means, for instance, shell crossing scales. So whenever you go to small scales, if you only take dark matter, for instance, you have shell crossing and you have things clustering and becoming nonlinear. So what you're integrating over are these nonlinear modes for dark matter. You can, of course, include whichever new physics you have in your EV, but this is an effective theory of gravity. So those are all the counterterms allowed by the gravity symmetries of the problem, which is basically GR. So it's basically taking all the terms allowed by GR symmetries.
Okay, so there is like a effective action with GR relativity terms that, for example, that C4 is coming from one of those terms in that action, and it's
let's take the first ones here, which are the easiest ones to understand. So the first terms here, those terms proportion to k square, you can understand them as simply as fluid velocities. So this is the let's say the most straightforward intuition for those terms, which are basically some k square contributions, which is some derivative expansion over those small scale modes and how they affect the larger scale modes. So,
okay, and there is something else that is confusing. So all of these terms are local in Fourier space, and that says something about the interactions in the that they came from. So what is the underlying assumption here that leads to
the underlying assumption is if you take GR, which means let's take the equivalence principle as the the ground point of this model, and we take all the symmetries allowed by GR, and we take all the contractions of del I, del J of the gravitational potential. So those are all local in space contributions from del I, del J of the gravitational potential. So you can have all the contractions possible from this term, which gives you, for instance, this k square. If you use Poisson equation, the first term you get is basically this term. And then all the other terms are basically contractions of del I, del J of the gravitational potential. and the velocity potential, because at some point velocity also starts to move relevant.
Okay, thank you.
But can I just follow up on that? It's not quite true that these are local in K-space, because I mean, I think they involve convolutions over, I don't have expressions for this, but isn't that true that some of these, like I think P1 and P2 and other, that are like multiple K integrals inside of them?
They're local in real space, not in Fourier space.
I see.
Yeah. So in chaos space, these higher order terms, they're all kind of delocalized in chaos space, I think. Yeah.
I see. But they're local in the real. Okay.
Yeah, in real space, they're all local. And it's there's actually something more complicated here that's hidden in an assumption that because the theory is non local in time, because like structure formation process takes like Hubble time. So this is a long lasting discussion. I think it's we could of course talk more about that. But this is a theory that's local in space and non-local in time. All the terms that are lowered by now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, sorry.
Okay, good.
Another question.
Please go on.
Okay, yeah. So what we have seen here in this work is that after adding this three loop contribution, we find this convergence radius, which is indicating that the series, the ZFT series, actually behaves as an asymptotic series, in which if you add more terms, there is a convergence radius in which you actually perform better. But adding more terms, like specifically in this regime, first, it means you're overfitting this two loop contribution because it's a power law on some scales. And second, we don't believe we can gain much here from those scales. So it actually indicates some convergence radius, which is, I think it's a nice result. Yeah, let me talk about the work I'm doing in collaboration with Thiago Magulhão and other people. So Thiago is now a PhD student in Edinburgh, and I was supervising him in this work. And what we did is a multi-tracer analysis of this effective theory. So it means taking one sample, take one galaxy sample, and instead of doing one single tracer analysis for this galaxy sample, you split in two catalogs and do some multi-tracer analysis. So it involves basically the cross-correlation between those tracers A and B. And what we find is that actually by doing that, you gain a lot of information in the cosmological parameters, and you see better constraints from H, from MXDM, and from B12. So what we see, actually, the reason for that is the following. So by taking the cross-correlation between those tracers, you actually break the degeneracy between, in specifically in the multipoles of the galaxies. So what you see here is the tracer BB cross-correlated and the tracer AA cross-correlated. And what we see is these strong fingers of God suppression for the BB cross-correlation, which means that whenever you try to fit parameters together for this term, you're going to get the bias parameters, this huge set of bias parameters that I was describing. You gain information from the cross product of them. So what you see here is actually you gain a lot of information compared to single tracer. If you go to multi-tracer, you break degeneracy between cosmological parameters and this huge set of bias parameters. So I think multi-tracer is one nice way to get around this large number of parameters, because you actually break a lot of degeneracy when you break one single tracer into different species.
Hi, sorry, can I ask another question on that slide? So your multi-tracer, how did you split your galaxy sample, and what was the reason for choosing that split? Like, was it based on, you wanted to have different biases or different?
Yeah, ideally, in the best case scenario, we would like to split our multi-tracer in order to maximize this bias difference between your tracers, right? And take all this bias parameter space, and you want to maximize basically the difference between those two tracers in order to basically have better constraints and most information extraction. In this case, of course...
Right, so then if you... Oh, sorry. Yeah, keep going, sorry.
Yeah, so of course we cannot split by the bias because it's not something you directly measure, right? So in this case, you have to find something that resembles your bias difference. In this case, what we are using star formation ratio in this project, which also is something very similar to color. So it's basically, you can understand this split as a color split. So what I'm showing here is actually take one red sample and split this in two. And what I'm showing in red here is the red air sampler inside this red sample. So this is the blue sample inside this sample, and this is the red sample. It's basically a color split.
Okay, and did you just split it half-half, or did you have, like, multiple bins, and you took, like, the reddest of the bins and the bluest of the bins or something?
Yeah,
like
so we want to play with that, and how to split exactly. In this case, what we wanted to have is exactly one tracer split that gives similar shot noise for both samples. So we chose to split following some short noise criteria, which have the same number of tracers in both catalogs.
Yeah, okay, wait, sorry. You said same number of tracers,
same number
sorry,
of objects.
Sorry, I think I missed it, but the same number of objects, right. But did you just split it half-half, or were there...
Yeah, this was half-half.
Half-half? Okay, so it was like right at the middle, you just split it in. Okay,
exactly. Okay. I have some plot for that in the backup slides, but... yeah, but we played a lot with not how to split, but we played a lot with the shot noise here, showing that the shot noise is not that relevant on those scales. We also played with the volume of the survey in these projects. So there's a lot of tests we have carried, and yeah, so we analyzed quite a lot of different setups for concluding that multi-tracing provides better results. Right. So let me now go back to this EFT story and talk about the main topic of this talk, which is the RG running of the coupling constants that you have. So this is a very complicated slide, I know, in terms of formulas, but let's try to formulate this EFT framework instead of doing this in terms of equations of motion directly. Let's do it in terms of partition function. And what we have here is a partition function for your linear density field phi. And in terms of a free action, and an interaction term between your fields. So you can read this phi here as being the density field, and J here is a current couple to this phi. So this is approach based on a paper from Shankaro, Ashnauer, and Pollock from 10 years ago. And their idea is basically having the free theory, basically describing the initial conditions of the matter density field and integrating over the initial densities. So this is a way to basically take derivatives of this partition function and calculate observables, namely the endpoint function that we have, and integrating over the initial conditions over many insertions of the density field that you have in order to take your endpoint function. So this is a path integral way to pose this EFT problem. In terms of framework, I know in terms of equation, it's hard to understand, but it's also very beautiful because it's a path integral formulation of this EFT story. And if you want to understand it better, you can just take this phi here. I'm just using phi because it's the notation you use, but you can take this phi to be delta, the density field, and delta is basically expanded in terms of linear density fields that you have. So you can expand delta as the first term, being just the linear part, plus some quadratic coupling. So this K here would be something analog to the F2 or G2 term in the case of standard perturbation theory. I know it's also complicated, the equation here, but I'll just say that you can take those coupling constants and then take derivatives with respect to lambda and basically do the RG flow for those couplings. Namely, you're basically taking the partition functions directly from the partition function, you're building the RG equation. And it's very beautiful because it has some advantages, which I'm listing here. First, it's a path integral formulation, which in my opinion makes things a bit clearer when you understand what's happening here. Also, it's a systematic way to generate this effective field theory structure, directly imposing, and seeing that it's closed under randomization. And if it's not closed under randomization, you can actually check for the term they're missing, and you already have everything here in control. Right? Also, something they comment is it's a way to keep small yet perturbative modes in the framework. So because you're not cutting in your vertex, like you're not just randomizing your vertex, but you're randomizing over the initial fields, you can actually keep track of small scales, but you treat them perturbatively. You can keep all the perturbative small modes in the theory. It's a technical thing, but it's something we find also very interesting from this approach that they have presented. Right, so let me move now.
Sorry, can I ask a question? Can you go back? So at the top right, you have this definition of S0, which is quadratic. Is the phi i, do you mean phi i initial there?
Yeah, FireEye initial. Yeah.
Okay, the top right, that's FireEye initial.
Well, actually, yeah, for Gaussian initial conditions, you can say it's the same, right? Here in this case, and you can neglect the bispectral terms, the cubic terms.
Mm-hmm. So lambda is like a cutoff, but the cutoff is in the space of initial conditions.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, I see. And then, but the actual observed thing is this phi i SPT.
Phi i SPT is the nonlinear field.
It's what we observe. And okay.
Yeah, so this is what we observe. And this, like here, they're not including the counter terms specifically here in this part, but we can say the EFT is basically the SPT plus some counter terms. So this is what we observe. This is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
No. So let me move now to the bias expansion and what is this bias expansion and how we can construct a similar approach for the bias expansion and understand the range of the bias parameters. Yeah, also please, if you have any questions, just jump in. So let me just recap what I mean by the RG flow. And we know from QFT that basically observables cannot depend on the cutoff that you have, but actually coupling constants can actually have this flow in parameter space, which can be understood in terms of the Kalman-Simoncic equation. So whenever you have a coupling constant G and how it evolves in terms of the energy scale of your experiment, new here is given by the beta function of your theory. In the case of QED, we have the beta function of the electron charge with something like proportional to the electron charge qubit. You can calculate this in terms of the first contribution, the diagrammatic contribution. In terms of QCD, you also find a beta function for your gauge coupling in QCD, which will be proportional, for instance, to the number of families that you have and some other constants here. The main idea is how can we understand these RG coupling and bring that to the picture we want to for the bias parameters. So I'm just giving you here a historical recap of these whole RG story and randomization story. So around the 50s, Dim Reg and scale transformations were introduced in the context of QED by Stuckelberg, Perelman, and Petermann and Gell-Mann. In condensed matter, it started to be applied one decade later. And a lot of understanding actually came in the 70s and in the 80s when Kalman-Simoncic and Kenneth Wilson formalized the RG for the continuum and derived the whole RG equations that we know and analyze it in terms of quick phenomena. Also, a major step happened 10 years later with Joe Polchinskin after introducing path integrals. This is what's known nowadays as the Wilson-Polchinski approach via path integrals for deriving the RG equations. And in terms of frameworks, we have two different frameworks to understand the randomization group. The first framework is this Wilson-Polchinski approach that I mentioned, which comes with the intuition of a sliding cutoff. So you have a cutoff lambda of your theory, and you basically slide this cutoff between lambda and lambda prime, and integrate out modes that live in this shell between lambda and lambda prime. So this is the approach we took in this work, specifically because in this partition function story, it's a very nice way because you just have two different cutoffs and integrate exactly between lambda and lambda prime. This is exactly what we're going to do for the bias parameters here. But just to mention, you also have a second framework, which is widely used, actually more used in the literature, just because for practical computations, it's just simpler. Whenever you want to go to true loops, it's just easier and also for more complicated theories. And it comes with the idea of instead of having a sliding cutoff, you have a sliding randomization condition. So basically, you use DIMREG and you basically take the randomization condition on different scales mu and you say it has been dependent on where you set this randomization condition. So the context in which you want to apply this is to the galaxy bias expansion. And to explain that better, what I'm showing you here is the dark matter field and the Barons field. So what we observe is here on the right, the Barons field, and we want to relate how the Barons that we observe relate to dark matter and the underlying density field, which is basically what we are interested in. And it comes with the name of bias expansion, this set of coefficients with these bias functions that I was showing before, how to relate the galaxy density field to the underlying matter density field. So what you see here are a set of operators constructed for matter. And what you see here on the left-hand side is basically the galaxy density field. And what we have is a set of coefficients that basically will tell how to relate the Barons that we observe to the dark matter That's the underlying tracer that we want to estimate things for. So the galaxy bias expansion, which I summarize in this formula here, I'm going to explain what exactly I mean by this formula. And as I was showing before to you, we have a set of coefficients, which we call the bias coefficients and stochastic coefficients. So you also have stochastic fields, which I show here and here, and one major set of fields, which are the operators constructed on top of the GR symmetries of the problem. So the coefficients that you have here multiplying some operators, and those operators are the contractions of del I, del j of the gravitational potential. And at first order, the first thing that appears is just delta, the matter density field. At second order, you have something like delta square and this Galilean operator, which is some contraction of del I, del j of phi. And at third order, you have this set of operators. So this is what's called the galaxy bias expansion. And one of the main features of the expansion is that it actually has to be renormalized. And one of the reasons for that is because you have quadratic and cubic operators here. So as you see, those contributions, those terms here actually have contributions coming from very small scales. And they actually, when you go to Fourier space, which I'm showing here, those operators in Fourier space, they actually depend on the cutoff scale lambda that you put for your calculations. So one procedure is actually to try to define a renormalized operator O with those bars here. And the notation here means we are subtracting things that depend on lambda to cancel out the lambda dependence. So this is the usual subtracting infinity procedure for minimization, which means trying to determine exactly how those operators depend on the cutoff scale that you have and subtract those in order to have a renormalized theory. Right, so there are different ways to set these renormalization conditions, and basically the way pointed out in this paper here from 2014 is to use endpoint functions to renormalize your bias parameters. It means taking some limits of cross correlators. In this case, we can define the renormalized B delta here in the K going to zero limit. So you take your galaxy density field, cross correlate with the density field, and this is the definition of the linear bias. And similarly for quadratic operators. So the idea is take the n order bias parameter that you have and use n plus one point functions to renormalize this. Very complicated way to put it is to use this formula here in which we relate the renormalized operator to the leading order contribution of the operator. But just to show some example and don't get so complicated, don't make things so complicated, the renormalized delta square that you have is just a delta square minus some sigma contribution, so the variance of the density field that you have, times other operators. So this is just a rotation in terms of your basis in order to cancel out the dependence with lambda. So for a fixed lambda, you can just rotate the basis this way and have the renormalized operators then fine. Right, so the idea that we had is instead of subtracting infinities and constructing the basis on top of renormalized operator, can we go beyond? And the main motivation that we had for this comes from Joe Pochinski's paper from 83, in which he says, originally it was just a mean of removing infinities from perturbative populations, this whole RG story. But what he comments is that a great improvement comes when one takes seriously the idea of having a physical cutoff at a very large energy scale lambda. So actually taking this lambda scales seriously in the problem. So the motivation for us to go beyond and define the parameters in a finite lambda story actually come from different fields. So I'm just showing you here different types of motivation that we had. First, if you come from lattice, for you, it's very natural to have your bias parameters depend on the smoothing scale that you have in your lattice. Also, if you come from high energy physics, it's very natural for you that everything is an effective theory. And if you basically building the RG flow is the next thing you have to do. Also, in terms of MCMC exploration in the cosmos side, we want to be quite sure that we are not messing up with the priors in this effective field theory regime, and we want to know exactly on top of which parameters we are putting the priors on. And finally, there's a lot of people that don't like this EFT perspective because it has many parameters. But again, what I'm saying here is that we have a bunch of free parameters, but we have to include them because they are the most general allowed terms, and we have to include them to be sure that theory is consistent. And what we show here,
I have a question here. So when you are doing this RG, I'm trying to understand. So you keep this lambda within perturbative range, right? So you never Because yeah, exactly. We have like a physical cutoff, which is short scale. So your lambda is always below this physical one, right?
KNO.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, that's true. So lambda here, which is this cutoff that we have, has to be below this cutoff range, which is the nonlinear, the point in which the nonlinearities start, like the system starts to become strongly coupled, let's say.
Yeah, then what's the advantage of keeping it finite lambda? Why not send it to infinity like people do in FQ all the time? And basically, I mean, there is some kind of fiducial cutoff, but then it's sent to infinity.
Yeah, we can do that in terms of calculation, I mean, just to calculate things.
You are keeping it finite and you say you can, can you improve precision? Yeah, I'm just trying to understand because, yes, for example, in QFT, I mean, this RG allows to resum certain class of multi loop diagrams, actually.
I'm going to comment on that later.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to comment exactly the analogy later, and we can maybe can we. Yeah, I'm going to show you the slide.
Okay, go ahead.
So, yeah, what we had then is to draw the partition function for this galaxy bias expansion. And what I'm showing here is this partition function, again, integrating over the matter smoothed out on the initial condition. So we have a smoothed initial condition, d lambda here. And what we have is some terms proportional to j and some terms proportional to j square. And you, of course, have higher order powers of j. I'm going to explain in a minute why we have these terms. So the way we have, we understand this equation is, again, you have a path integral over the initial smooth density field, but you have a single current term here, which gives you the bias parameters that whenever you take derivatives with respect to J, you're going to find exactly this term should be the one leading to the leading bias parameters. But the terms proportional to J square actually contribute to the two-point function. You can understand this as being the stochastic contributions to the two-point function, for instance. So this P epsilon, this epsilon here is basically some stochasticity that you add, because whenever you have this term, you're actually going to see that this term starts to source J square contributions whenever you integrate over the shells. So these J square contributions have to be there because they are sourced by the J to the first contributions. So to have a theory that's actually closed in the organization, we have to include all powers in J. But fortunately, the system is closed under J, and you can analyze fixed one order in J and do the analysis for this. I know it's a bit technical at this point. We're just trying to show the bias partition function and what it looks like. And again, moving to this derivation, I'm going to try to make it clear because I know it's a complicated slide. But again, the idea is taking Wilson-Pochinsky approach and integrating over a shell. So what we have is a momenta shell between lambda and lambda prime. And we want to bring this shell in momenta with the small lambda here. We want to take the limit in which this lambda goes to zero and integrate out the shell modes, the modes that live in this delta shell. So what we do is exactly Taylor expand this partition function that we had. And we see that we have the usual term that we had before in a cutoff lambda prime plus some contribution. So whenever you Taylor expand this, you find this second line here to be the contributions to those bias parameters. Basically, they will be the ones that drive your parameters between lambda and lambda prime. So let's try to understand what's appearing here in this line, because I know this is a complicated expression, but there is a very systematic and beautiful way to understand this in terms of diagram. So the first contributions that we see, the first corrections that we see are some corrections to the bias parameters, which come from this type of diagrams. So those are basically the corrections that will basically give you the running of the bias parameters. The second terms that we see here in the second line is SOO. The reason why we call this S is because this is an integral over the shell. So what we do is splitting the integral here and we integrate between the shell. We can integrate out exactly the shell. And this type of shell contributions are exactly what appear. So there is a very beautiful diagrammatic way to understand this expression and how we can bring corrections to the bias and stochastic parameters. Just to give you one example, again, you don't get crazy in those expressions. What I see here is the correction coming from delta square. So when you take delta square, your delta square operator, and integrate it over a shell, so this red line here is a shell, when you integrate over this shell, what appears is a contribution to delta, the linear field, is another contribution to delta square, the delta square that you have, and the Galilean term. So it means that when integrate out the shell of delta squared, you're actually sourcing the order operators. You of course have higher derivatives and higher order operators being sourced. But the point here is shell contributions from one operator sourcing the other operators. And what you see here in this part is the integral over the linear spectrum, a shell of linear spectrum. Basically, your spectrum, your linear spectrum integrated between lambda and lambda plus no lambda. We can read this as the variance of your linear density field on the scale lambda. So the physical interpretation for this is basically take your linear density field, and this is basically the variance, how the variance of the linear density field changes when you run your scale lambda. Right. So
hi, sorry, I've got a very, very basic question when it comes to these diagrams. I guess, would you mind kind of breaking it down for me, like the diagram here and the diagrams previous page, how they relate to, like, how do you interpret them physically in relation to, say, a matter field or a galaxy field or something along those lines?
Thanks. So it's a common thing in this area that whenever you write a paper, you have to introduce some new notations for these diagrams and to make people more confused about it. So in this case here, what we have here is basically the operator that you have. So SO is basically, you can count the legs, and this is the order of operator. So delta, so S of delta here would be only one leg coming out of this term. So this term, for instance, if you neglect the dots here, it would be a fourth order operator. So the way to read it, like this part is basically a convolution going from real space to Fourier space. So this is basically how you take your operator and basically bring it to number of internal legs here. This part here is the usual SPT expansion, these legs here, this vertex that you see here. So this is basically taking each one of the vertex that you had and expanding in terms of linear density fields. So each one of the outgoing lines here that you see are linear density fields. So these linear initial condition density fields that you have. And the red line here is taking one contraction between two different, inside the same operator, you take one contraction. And this red line lives in a shell. So it means that it's a high moment. So it means this guy, we take the limit in which this guy goes to infinity. So this is the grammatic way to read this guy. I don't know if it was clear. Or...
Yeah, that makes more sense. Thank you very much.
So I have another question. So I guess the thing I'm a bit confused is that these are convolutions in the Fourier space. So they involve multiple k's, but then you end up with just one k, which is the momentum of the shell. Mm-hmm.
So those are convolutions in Fourier space. The truth. So k is the external momentum here that you have. So this is the k, and it splits into different convolution bytes. So these are basically the internal legs that you have. And those legs here are basically those that will source the other operators. So this, let's think about this term here. So this term delta one is basically a term that has one leg. So it means only having one of those dashed lines here. So it means you only take the diagram that has basically one of those legs here. So this is an external leg,
Okay. But I still am a bit confused. So you have this cutoff, and this cutoff, I mean, it applies to both internal and external legs, don't they?
The cutoff are applied exactly over the internal legs here, in these legs here. So those dashed lines are have the cutoff lambda on them.
Mm-hmm.
So those fields here.
Okay, maybe I should let you finish, and maybe I become clearer. Okay, thank you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have two pages introducing notation here in this paper, so it's a complicated topic. Right, so whenever, after drawing all those diagrams for all the operators at first and second order, this is the final result that we have. So this is the result after integrating out using this Polchinski-Wilson approach, and those are the final equations that we find. So there are some comments on top of those equations I would like to draw. First, it's a linear ODE system, which means you can basically ask mathematically to solve it. It's linear in the bias. You see that there is no B delta squared here. So you can actually ask mathematically to solve it, and it's very, very easy. Finally, something I would like to point is that whenever you take a parameter that's order one here, it relates to parameters that are order one, two, and three. So this guy is order two, this guy is order three, this guy is order three. If you take a parameter that's order two as this guy, it relates to parameters that are order three, four. So here, this guy is order four. So it brings a question, which is how can you close this hierarchy? You have to solve for all the bias parameters in order to have something consistent. And this is a question we have addressed and saying that actually you don't have to solve for all the parameters. You can truncate this and it's fine to truncate this. We have a long discussion on how to truncate this. But let me just point out to some solutions to those equations. And these, again, the typical solutions that we found in which you have the bias parameters evolving from a finite lambda towards lower lambda. And the reason why we discuss lambda going to zero will be clear in a minute too. So we are bringing the parameters actually to lower values of lambda. Right, and this is the typical RG flow that you have. And some features, as already pointed out, is actually you can source some bias parameters and even the bias parameters can change sign. So there is a diagrammatic way to understand those equations again and how they source. If you take a parameter that's order one in order j to the first, actually it will be sourced by parameters that are order two or order three. So this is what we did in the first paper, and what's coming out, expect this week or next week, is actually generalizing it to J square and higher derivative parameters and making this situation, you know, connecting all the vertex, including higher derivative operators and stochastic operators, and how they actually J to the first operators contribute to J to the second operators. So there's actually a connection between them. And let's talk about the connection between different neuronymization schemes. So this scheme in which you subtract infinities and the scheme that we have here in which we keep lambda finite, how can we connect both? And there is a nice understanding on that, which is basically whenever you take the IR limit, which means taking lambda and bringing this lambda to zero, running your parameters towards lambda to zero, you actually find exactly the same parameter in which they define here using their neuronymization scheme, using the Anakin function. And the reason for this is this very nice connection with what's called the separate universe picture, in which the bias parameters that they have here are basically the separate universe bias parameters. In our case, taking lambda to zero means exactly taking this IR limit in which you're basically taking your integration scale, bringing it to zero. And this is basically telling you how to connect the bias parameters that you measure in a finite lambda, as we described here, and you take this limit lambda going to zero. And you actually match the value that you find using the separate universe feature. So this is basically running the parameters towards the IR. And just some final remarks here. First, let me try to address this question about the logs, because I think this is a very interesting point and brings us to this question whether we can extract more information. Let's think about logs in QFT. So this I took from Weinberg's book. There's a very nice discussion in there in which he discussed how logs appear in QFT. And in QFT, logs appear whenever you have two dimensional scales, E and M here in this case, and you take a limit in which one of the scales is larger than the second one. And what you see is that what's going to appear is that your amplitude gamma here will depend on your energy scale, just in power D, the dimension of the problem, times some logs that scale as E to the M. And one of the beautiful things of the RG equations is exactly because you do this resummation of logs straight ahead. You don't have to do it by hand, you know? So there are either two ways. The first approach is you either resum by hand. So this, I'm just showing the resummation of the electron charge. And you can, of course, take the whole Dyson series and take the whole diagrams and resum them. And fortunately for this case, you can actually find a closed form for this and you can find exactly how the defective electron charge behaves. The other approach is taking the RG approach and just doing the resummation, just take the RG equations and solve the RG equations and you actually get the same result. So you're basically resumming the whole logs just by default. You have the whole logs for free. I think it's exactly this resummation that was mentioned before. And the reason why in the case of LSS, it's a bit different because we don't have those logs. So unfortunately, we don't have those logs. And this was pointed out in this paper here from 2013, in which if you take the one loop spectra and you split this contribution into a part that doesn't have the logs and a part that has the logs, we see that this alpha tilde property is basically for different universes. So n here is the scaling index of your universe. For many of those universes, those logs are basically zero. And you don't have those logs in LSS. So at least for the leading bias parameters, we don't expect you to see those logs. But as long as we're dealing with the leading parameters, there are other discussions. We can include the other scales in the problem. Like I think it's just the beginning, because there are other effects like neutrinos or even going to two loops or that in which we can see maybe there's some hope to have those logs and to have the RG being more relevant. But there are still many relevant things we can use with the RG equations for. And I just list some difference between the two randomization schemes that we have, that in practice, if you use this endpoint randomization, you have to keep track and subtract all the UV-dependent parts. And as I said, it's very complicated whenever you go to three-point function, four-point function, it's a very complicated thing. And we find at lambda, we can actually do this running of the lambda and go to lambda going to zero and do the match between the parameter that you want, that you actually put the priors on top to the parameters you're measuring in your legends. It also provides extra sanity checks because you can check how your parameters evolve with lambda. And in terms of diagrams here, I'm just showing some compilation of diagrams and how they behave for different cases. It's just to mention that in the case in which you subtract things, you subtract also subleading parts, whereas in the case of finite lambda, you keep everything finite, and lambda here is just a finite parameter that you have in your approach. So the reason why you should care, let me just sum up everything that we had, is this approach allows for extra cross-check in this EFT inference process, because you know exactly on top of which parameters you're putting your priors on. You have lambda finite and you keep your lambda in the theory. So it's a very systematic way to set priors in your theory. Whenever you bring lambda to infinity, to zero, you have this separate universe picture. It's also a very systematic way to construct randomization for all endpoint functions and absorb instead of just subtracting the cutoff contributions, you keep them finite, and you also absorb the subleading contributions in this case. So yeah, thanks a lot.
Okay, great. All right. Yeah. Yes, thanks, Enrique. So why don't we give him a round of applause for his great talk? Okay. Yes, we have maybe time for a couple of brief questions. So Sergey, go ahead.
So I'm still trying to understand the meaning of this lambda. So, as you said, in QED, I resum the diagrams, and then the kind of the randomization scale or RG scale will be characteristic momentum of the or energy of the process. So in your case, you actually have a slide where you show the running of these bias parameters as a function of lambda. For example, here. So should I think of this lambda as a physical scale where I measure basically the power spectrum and that these bias parameters will obey this running? So it's kind of should I think of this as B of K? Yeah. Should I substitute lambda to be equal to K of the mode that I'm measuring?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a physical scale because.
Because precisely like in QFT, this log thing, it allows basically to go from cutoff, UV cutoff, into physical energy scale. Yeah. So basically the running, the dependence on the cutoff is the same as the dependence on the physical scale. So here it's not the case, no?
It's not the case. So lambda here is something you want to keep in between K max and K and L, for instance. So here it's a scale you want to use. It's an arbitrary scale. It's not a physical scale. You can understand this. If you go, the way to understand this perhaps is going to a lattice in which you have your delta defined in a lattice, like a simulation, and you measure your bias parameters in a lambda. And the way to understand this lambda is the smoothing scale you do in your lattice. But this is, I don't think it's really training physical scale, but as you said, we want to keep this to be smaller than K and L because this is basically the where strong couplings sets in. You don't trust your effective theory anymore, right? So there is a range of scales allowed to keep this lambda. I would say it's between the K max you use for your fit and K and L, which is the nonlinear scale.
I see. Yeah, and another question. So when you do this calculation, basically you have to relate final field to the initial field. So you also include counter terms in there, right? Which also run, I believe, right? or
right here? You mean like let me go back here to this part, right? Yeah, which part? This part, you mean?
Yeah, right. I mean, well, when you do the running, right? There are say these EFT counter terms inside.
Oh yeah, like yeah. There's yes. Yeah, there's
so
yes.
They run as well. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So they run, and let me show this slide here, which is what we are doing now, is exactly the running of higher derivative terms. So we can understand CS has been a higher derivative term, right? And the point is that all those operators will actually source CS square when you renormalize them. So you see here, this vertex is basically the CS square vertex that you have. So all arrows points to this point. So it basically, this guy will receive a lot of contributions from bias parameters and also from the matter contributions themselves, mm-hmm. right, which is the CS square.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, but by the way, I think there is an important difference. If I'm not wrong, this partition function, you also have worked with this partition function probe, right? There is a paper in which there's some, I think there's a paper from Misha Ivanov, Matthias Garni, in which they use this partition function approach, but they integrate over the final conditions. And what we have here is an integral over the initial condition.
Yeah.
Just to make this point.
Okay. So Marco, so before you had your hand raised, was your question answered or?
No, okay. If I have time for a quick question, how can you check systematically that all the biases, if you go to higher order, are independent? Is there a systematic way to find independent operators in this bias approach, or you check by hand?
Let me know if you understood the question. If there is a systematic way to go to higher order bias parameters and identify which bias parameters you have.
Yeah, I mean, if for example, in SMEFT, if I write all the operators, there will be redundancies.
Definitely. So whenever you take, as I mentioned before, the building block here is something like del I, del j of the gravitational potential, right? And of course, there's a lot of redundancy there. And it's actually an effort now to, whenever we try to push through two loops, there are going to be a lot of counter terms, and a lot of those are redundant. So you can already, at third order, you can already eliminate some redundancy. So there is, the systematic way to answer your question, the systematic way is taking all the possible operators and then showing explicitly those redundancies, like in SMEFT.
Okay, thanks.
So let's see, go ahead.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for the nice talk. Was very interesting. So I have one comment and some questions. The comment is, I don't know if you are aware of asymptotically shaped gravity. There is a lot of work in the direction of computing renormalization group flows of gravity matter systems, and also in connection to cosmology and determining the flow of running couplings.
Can you send me those references later? I'll definitely be happy to.
Yeah. So asymptotically shaped gravity is essentially one approach to quantum gravity based on quantum field theory. And there, one of the main tools is using the renormalization group flow from the limit lambda to infinity in your notation and defining the new ultraviolet completion with respect to an interacting fixed point, and then flowing down in order to see what we see in the infrared. There is also work looking at these flows with gravity coupled with matter and also in connection with cosmology. Although I have to say I haven't seen so far the connections with large scale structures and these galaxy bias parameters. So this was the comment, and I also have some questions. So first, I wanted to ask you if there is really a precise connection between the rounding of these galaxy bias parameters and the rounding couplings in your action, because then with these techniques in asymptotic set, it would be possible to connect the two. So first, this question.
So the question is whether there is a connection between running of those bias with the running of what? Sorry?
The couplings in your action.
The couplings, but the
coupling constants.
But the coupling constants here would be something like the bees themselves.
Yeah, so exactly, connection between bees and whatever you have in your action.
Yeah, so what comes in the action is B times some momenta structure. So what comes here in this action is exactly B times one operator. So you can understand the B as being the adjoint basis of the operator. So whenever you run, you integrate over a shelling operator, these will sum to the B. So yeah, B or Bs are basically the coupling constants in this case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And then I also wanted to comment on the, I'm picking up on what Sergei already said. I think it is very important to look at the continuum limit and what your equations, your normalization group equations do in the limit where lambda goes to infinity. Because if you have infinities, then it is hard to trust your results in the infrared. And if we have a fixed point in that limit, then you have announced predictive power, because then you can compute some of the parameters that you have in the infrared, like from scratch. And this is, I think, all of the power of the normalization group is exactly in your continuum limit and the possibility of, instead of having essentially a bunch of free parameters as in effective field theory, you will be able to compute some of them.
Yeah, yeah. So this running towards lambda infinity is something we've been discussing, because this is a question we're getting very often. What happens when you run lambda to infinity? So the point for us is, as I was mentioning here in these equations, it's there is a non-trivial way to discuss those equations in terms of how to truncate this hierarchy, because the second order bias parameters depend on the fourth order, and the fourth order will depend on the sixth order. So all the system is coupled. What we show is that using some ansatz, you can truncate this. But all I wanted to say is that there is, for us, the way we found to truncate this and solve the running towards lambda infinity is, it's not clear yet. We're investigating that now.
Okay. Yeah, of course, you can investigate the dependence within the approximation that you have, but if it doesn't work, you would need higher order visits too.
Exactly. So this is so the concern we have now is that we would have to have the whole running of the whole high order bias operator. And this is, well,
yes.
Either we find some time models in which it applies or it's a non-trivial set of
equations. Another thing that you could do is to instead write down the normalization group equations in terms of the Wetterich equation instead of Wilson-Polchinski, because calculation tend to be easier with that.
Yeah, definitely.
So you have one term in it.
Yeah, thanks again. This question is, this is something, of course, it came to us that we should use the other approach. But the point is here, for cosmology, the propagators are the linear spectrum. And the linear spectrum, the linear power spectrum for matter, has a very weird shape. It's not like in the context of QFTs, you have 1 over k squared or something like this, right? So in this case, the propagator is something way more complicated. And we cannot actually integrate things and do this. It's just a matter on how to do dim reg. We cannot do dim reg for cosmology. At least it hasn't been done so far.
I think I would give it a try with the Wetterich equations. Can be powerful in this one. This is my guess since I work.
But in terms of calculating things, dim reg is quite non-straightforward here because the propagator is not one of the case.
But we wouldn't use dim reg. But in any case, so maybe I can send you a couple of references.
Okay.
Thank you.
So we're like 17 minutes past the hour. So why don't we stop here? Thanks again, Enrique. For a very stimulating talk.